Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Thursday, April 12th, 2018. The time is 9:24 a.m. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
Good morning.
Senator Stevens.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
On today's agenda, we have three items. I am going to set aside SB 185. We'll take that one up this afternoon to try to get us back on time. I apologize for the delay. We are trying to work and get Alaska's business done in 90 days, which is requiring some intense conversations about the bills before us. The two items remaining on this morning's agenda is SB 193, Medical Assistance Work Requirement, and HB 79, Omnibus Workers' Compensation. Is there anything to come before the committee before I begin? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to invite Senator Kelly and his staff, Heather Carpenter, to the microphones to introduce the Senate Bill 193. Ms. Carpenter, welcome to Senate Finance.
Good morning, Co-Chair McKinnon and members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Heather Carpenter, staff to Senator Pete Kelly. Senator Kelly is on other business in the building right now, but I'm sure he will join us as soon as he can. I'll give just some brief opening remarks about Senate Bill 193, and then I can walk through a sectional. So Senate Bill 193 is a bill that would direct the Department of Health and Social Services to apply for a Section 1115 waiver to implement work requirements as a condition of continued eligibility for Medicaid coverage in our able-bodied population. For those who might not be familiar with waivers and how new programs are implemented in the Medicaid program, a Section 1115 is a pretty broad waiver. They're some of the ones that we've been using with our Medicaid reform, and it's just a way to ask to bend the rules that are currently required. For the first time, CMS, or the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has changed their policy and will accept waivers that test the hypothesis that requiring work or community engagement as a condition of eligibility will result in more beneficiaries being employed or engaging in other productive community engagement, thus producing increased health and well-being. This is a really hot topic right now. Just 2 days ago, President Trump signed an executive order called Reducing Poverty in America by Promoting Opportunity and Economic Mobility. This executive order has a strong focus on work requirements for work-capable people. Our Medicaid program was set up to help our most vulnerable Alaskans, and it must continue to do so. However, the safety net program should not be used to hold people down indefinitely either, and Senate Bill 193 seeks to use our Medicaid program to actually lift individuals back up to a better quality of life by requiring 20 hours of work activity, volunteering, or subsistence activities each week. Senate Bill 193 includes several protections that will exempt individuals from the work requirement, including children, certain parents and caretakers, individuals with certain medical conditions, individuals enrolled in an education or training program, and those women that are pregnant. According to the Department of Health and Social Services, in their fiscal notes, Senate Bill 193 would impact approximately 25,095 Medicaid enrollees, or about 10.5% of the total enrollment. And remember, this is the able-bodied population, so the easiest way to look at that is our Medicaid expansion population and a few other special programs of Medicaid. Co-Chair McKinnon, from my experience of working directly with consumers who are also enrolled in Medicaid, they have hopes and dreams of jobs that will increase their wages, including abilities to buy cars. I've worked with so many individuals that tell me they want to go and buy maybe a big screen TV or a new car or anything, and they have to have a job in order to make those dreams come true. So this modest work requirement will help those individuals who could work on a path to become more successful. This program will set up ways to be accountable while trying out jobs or volunteer opportunities that could lead to rewarding career paths. Not to mention, I believe there'll be great mental health improvements that can come from having a routine outside of your home or during our long, cold, dark winter months. I know in Fairbanks, if you don't get outside in the winter and leave your home, it can be pretty depressing. So To Senator Kelly, it's really important that people understand this is not about, his first focus is not about saving money. It's about giving people the dignity of a job and helping them work off of poverty and become more successful. And our nonprofit sector should see some great benefit because they're going to have a whole new pool of volunteers to take advantage of. So with that, Madam Chair, I can walk through a sectional if you would like.
Are there questions on the intent of the bill? Ms. Carpenter, please walk us through a sectional.
Section 1, it's a one-section bill, so then I'll walk through the various subsections. It amends AS 4707036 to direct the Department of Health and Social Services to apply for a Section 1115 waiver of the Social Security Act to establish a work requirement for adults in the Medicaid program who do not meet the criteria to be exempted. The waiver must include the following. Subsection 1, which is on page 1, line 10, it requires an able-bodied Medicaid recipient to participate in work activities for a minimum of 20 hours each week. Actively seeking employment, participating in an education or training program, volunteering, or engaging in subsistence activities are also counted towards the 20-hour requirement. Subsection 2, which is on page 2, top of page 2, line 2, if a Medicaid recipient is also receiving benefits under the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program and in compliance with the work requirements listed under AS 4727035, then they automatically meet the work requirement for Medicaid. Subsection 3, which is on page 2, line 6, we exempt Medicaid recipients who are children or elderly, so that would be under 18 or over 65. B, the parent or caretaker of a dependent of a child up to 12 months of age, and the parent or caretaker is providing home care for the child. C, the parent or caretaker of a child experiences a disability, and the parent or caretaker is providing that home care for the children. The caretaker of a relative who is experiencing a disability and requires 24-hour care. E, the parent or caretaker of a child under 6 years of age, and the parent or caretaker demonstrated that appropriate child care is not available. F, somebody who is unable to work for medical reasons as determined by a licensed medical professional. G, somebody who is pregnant, and that one is actually required by the CMS guidance letter I provided for your committee. H, currently receiving unemployment insurance benefits. For your information, that program has its own work requirement, so we are trying to not be duplicative. And I, participating in a tribal work program, which is also required by the CMS guidance letter. Where we got most of these exemptions is our current temporary assistance program. The guidance letter from CMS asked us to line up our work requirements as much as possible. The bill on subsection 4, which is page 2, line 22, also allows for temporary exemptions for somebody who's experiencing a family hardship outside the control of a parent or caretaker, and that would be for the duration of the hardship. And somebody who is B, a victim of domestic violence, both of those temporary exemptions line up with our current TANF program. Subsection 5 on line 28, we ensure that the work requirement does not impact a Medicaid recipient from obtaining substance abuse treatment. Not only is that required by the CMS guidance letter, but we recognize our state is facing a pretty big opioid epidemic as well as ongoing substance abuse problems, and we want to make sure that any work requirement does not stop people from receiving treatment. And then finally, subsection 6, which starts at the bottom of page 2, line 31, and continues on to line 3, sets up a notification to all Medicaid recipients once the waiver is approved, and a 90-day notice of noncompliance with the work requirement before benefits are terminated. And this provision is a matter of due process for the recipients. So, Madam Chair, that is the bill.
Are there questions on the structure of the bill or the sectional analysis? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think you've hit on a very important issue here. My only concern is, and I really like the idea of helping people to get an education that would give them a job. But often what happens is the people who are in the situation don't have any money to get an education. So what are the options? What can we do to help people? How can we notify them that things are, that scholarships are available? Do you have any plans in that area, Heather?
So through the chair, Senator Stevens, our state actually has a pretty rich history, and I know Senator Bishop up there knows a lot of these programs that our Department of Labor actually allows. We have Workforce Investment Act grants. In Department of Labor, we have the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, which helps anybody who has a disability get back to work. They will often help pay for job training or education. So the university has a lot of things. As part of Senate Bill 74, the Medicaid reform bill we passed in 2016, we asked that as part of that, that the department would actually inform individuals on Medicaid of options for education or work availability. So certainly our vision would be to connect people. The department has, you know, a vision of how they would do this through the fiscal notes as well. So it could be a combination of using Department of Labor resources, university resources, and resources that the Department of Health and Social Services has.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Ms. Carpenter. I really appreciate your answer, and I assume the department then will provide some information, notification, as you mentioned, what is available to folks in terms of assistance in education. Thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Carpenter, your testimony of the sectional included a phrase that says these parameters align with the current TANF program. Could you expand on that, how you described the requirements for this Medicaid participation to work, the exemptions that you listed, et cetera? How do they, to the extent that they align with TANF?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I think they align almost completely now. There may be just one provision that we did not include, and I forgot my Title 47 statute book. So we literally opened up those statutes in the blue book and pulled them out, and that's what we based the bill on. And part of that was the CMS guidance letter to line up your work requirements with TANF and food stamps or SNAP. And then when we created a CS in the Senate HESS committee, we worked with the Department of Health and Social Services that wanted to see a couple other exemptions. Two of those, the two temporary exemptions, were actually at the request of the department because they're included in TANF.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So I will leave it to you to define TANF and SNAP. I can't define that off the top of my head, but the point I wanted to make, Ms. Carpenter, is that Health and Social Services has an existing program now that monitors or tracks work and volunteer hours already for Medicaid recipients. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, just for the record, TANF, I apologize, I should know better for speaking in acronyms at this committee, stands for Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. The Alaska-specific acronym is Alaska Temporary Assistance Program, and the SNAP program stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and that is otherwise known as food stamps. So while the department does currently have work requirements in place for both the food stamps and the temporary assistance program, the federal government has never allowed a work requirement for Medicaid. This guidance letter is the first time the federal government has shown any willingness to bend on this, and the way they specifically ask that it be implemented is that the states apply it, ask for it through an 1115 waiver.
Senator Von Imhoff, follow up.
This is my last comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Essentially, I guess what I wanted to state is that the processes by which to track this is in place. We can build upon current practices that are already in existence, pathways, systems that are already there. This should not be then too much of a heavy lift because we are not recreating the wheel.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, you are correct. Our Division of Public Assistance in the Department of Health and Social Services is the one that monitors and implements all of those programs, and that is exactly where the department has envisioned having this program be implemented as well.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Carpenter, I appreciate the provisions here regarding allowing subsistence time being spent as credit, but the problem that I have is how does one document that?
Ms. Carpenter.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we have not prescribed exactly how that would be documented. This 1115 waiver allows for a little bit of flexibility with working with the tribes and exactly how they would document that. I think we'd be open if you wanted to specify more in the bill how you would like to see that documented. We realize that is a little bit of a challenge with how we'd have to work with the tribes to document that subsistence piece specifically.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I bring this up. I don't know if I have a solution on how that is done, but it should be with minimal paperwork because people that are living the subsistence lifestyle don't necessarily have detail to great amounts of paperwork. And I know that the programs that are there, that is one of the major problems, is the amount of documentation that has to go for eligibility and re-eligibility, which is slowing down and complicating existing programs.
Senator Olson, did
you? Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Carpenter, we should ask this before, but because of all the exemptions that are there, it's at least what you said was only 10% of the population, of the enrollees are affected by this requirement. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the number, and with all the exemptions, is 25,095 individuals, and that translates from the fiscal notes into 10.5% of the current program.
Last question, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Olson.
Has to do with, has this been implemented in any other states, and have they, and what has been the success of it?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, this guidance letter, I think, is actually dated for January. So this is brand new program. Kentucky has had a waiver approved by CMS. There is some current litigation around that current waiver.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there other questions from committee members? Senator Bishop.
Just a comment. Heather, thank you, for Ms. Carter, for bringing this forward. And I see the bill sponsor in the back of the room. Welcome. I might want to bring James Harvey up from the Department of Labor and talk when we get to fiscal notes. I don't think we're going to get there today, but when we do, I'd just like to see him back there and just make sure he's here for the next meeting, because I want to get into that discussion, but not to take away from our schedule today.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. We will not be covering fiscal notes on this bill today. Senator Kelly, would you like to join us at the microphone? Your staff let the public know that you were on other state business. We have had an overview of the bill from your staff's perspective, as well as a sectional analysis, but comments from the sponsor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm grateful that you have brought this up in such a timely manner. My tardiness, as you were mentioning, I was either had a conversation with another member of the other body at that time, or I didn't have it at all, so I had to just choose that. Madam Chair, I'm sure Mrs. Carpenter went through this quite well. The sponsor statement, I think you'll find, explains the bill in its totality. There's probably an op-ed piece in your packet that represents my views on the subject. The subject is very widely popular in the state, across demographics, across party lines, across regions. I think most people agree that work is good for people, and we have a population of people that are dependent on the state. It is in their best interests to bring them into the working population or the voluntary population, or to recognize the value of the subsistence work that they do, but they should be doing it. And we will give them credit for doing that. And if they don't, then they have to forego benefits. They have to choose. And that is the same kind of choices that we all make every day when we get up and we go out the door and start to make a living. That is good for us. It's good for our children to see us doing that. And this bill has some intricacies to it, dealing with the 1115 waiver, et cetera. But really, it's at the heart of it is we all need to be working. We all need to be making Alaska a better place to live. And we welcome these people into that productive community.
Are there questions of the sponsor? President Kelly, thank you for joining us today. Thank you, Mrs. Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. With that, I'd like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 193, an act requiring the Department of Health and Social Services to apply for a waiver to establish work requirements for certain adults who are eligible for the state medical assistance program. I'd like to invite Jeremy Price, followed by Allison Curry. Welcome to Senate Finance, Mr. Price. If you could identify yourself for the record, any affiliation, and then please proceed with your testimony.
Thanks, Madam Co-Chair. My name is Jeremy Price. I'm the State Director of Americans for Prosperity, and I just would like to rise in support of this bill and thank the committee for taking this issue on. We think it's vitally important to the future of the state. From the national perspective, Kaiser Family Foundation puts Medicaid enrollment at 1 in 5 in the nation, and 25 million Americans are within that population of able-bodied adults that are part of the expansion population that are in this new population of individuals that are in that poverty line that can work. So you can look at other states and see that Alaska is headed for some serious problems in the future. We have no limits on enrollment in Medicaid. So the growth in that program, we can expect it will continue to grow. It was growing before expansion. So what we would love to see is the preservation of the program for folks who truly need it the most. Government assistance really should be a hand up, not a hand out, and except in the case of those who truly need the program. If you look at other states, the state of New York, the state of Maine, Alabama, Georgia, and Kansas all enacted welfare reform, mostly focused on food stamps. And all of the states experienced two things. One, when they enacted work requirements for food stamps or SNAP, they saw massive reductions in welfare assistance and increases in employment for low-skilled workers. One of the best examples in the country was New York, where they had 1.1 million people on welfare from 94 to 2004, and over that 10-year time period, that dropped to less than 400,000 after work requirements were put in place. We know this works. The 1996 federal welfare reform law under President Clinton, big success there, where welfare recipients were required to work after getting assistance after 3 months. There was a big drop in public assistance, while, again, an increase in employment for low-skilled workers. So we think the evidence is there in other government assistance programs. We think this will work, and most importantly, there is, and this is included in my comments I've submitted for the record with citations, but there is clear and convincing evidence that worklessness leads to depression, and depression leads to bad things. Someone who gets up every day and is able to look themselves in the mirror and say, okay, I've done something today, that goes a long way to their mental and physical health. And we have a serious problem in the state of Alaska with folks suffering from mental and physical problems. So we think this is a good bill. It's a good start. So thanks.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Maticki, followed by Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Price, for your testimony. I just one little minor correction. As you said, 1 in 5, it's closer to 1 in 3.39. or 3.4 Alaskans is a current recipient of Medicaid, which I think is I agree that it is about a hand up, and what I worry most about is the opportunities that those individuals are missing by us continuing to support a program without development expectations. So I appreciate your testimony. I just wanted to make sure that Alaskans realize that the number is considerably higher proportionally.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the listening and viewing audience, Mr. Price, can you give a brief description of the organization that you're here representing, the Americans for Prosperity?
Sure, yeah. So we're an organization that's dedicated to removing barriers of opportunity for Alaskans and Americans. So typically we advocate for lowering regulations, making it easier for people to start small businesses, keeping taxes as low as possible, empowering individuals to develop their own future and economic fortune.
And how many members do you have from rural Alaska in your organization?
I don't have that number in front of me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Price, thank you for joining Senate Finance. Oh, excuse me, we have one more question. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So through the chair, Mr. Price, I was curious if you could comment on when the bills was presented by Ms. Carpenter. She said one of the challenges, perhaps, was that folks get a job, earn enough income to rise above eligibility limits. There is a spot there where, with the high price of health care in Alaska, going above eligibility, having enough income to rise above eligibility is not necessarily enough income to pay for insurance coverage, health insurance coverage for yourself, let alone your children, in the exchange. Has your organization talked about potentially ideas to address that transition time for folks?
We haven't addressed that yet. You're right, there is a situation where there's a disincentive to make money and then not get the employment assistance or the government assistance. Yeah, that's a problem. We haven't identified a way to really resolve that, but generally, in a general sense, the more we can get folks working, the better off the society is. I mean, that's just a fact of the matter. And the problems that exist here in the state and across the country with the expansion of Medicaid, they're not going away anytime soon. In fact, they're going to get worse, right? The Medicaid assistance program is funded at different levels based on if you're in the expansion population or if you're in the traditional population. You know, a traditional 50-50% share between federal and states if I'm a disabled person. But if I'm in the expansion population, the federal government's covering 90%. Every state in the country that's expanded Medicaid is under projected enrollment, and the cost is far greater across the country than anyone expected. I think it's only a matter of time until the feds have to put more responsibility on the states.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. One of the things about Americans for Prosperity is that this group is also a very strong think tank. There is quite a bit of money behind researching important issues and bringing together stakeholders nationwide to discuss all the impacts of a particular issue. I urge your organization to look at this because as this 115 waiver gains momentum potentially throughout the United States, this issue of rising above eligibility and then not being able to afford health care is going to be more and more of an issue. One of the things that we've talked about with Health and Social Services in the past has been, is there a transition level where the state could possibly help pay for premiums on the exchange? So it's not necessarily full-blown Medicaid coverage, but a premium coverage that I think would give some financial aid during this transition time. It has been an idea discussed by several individuals already in the past here, and I urge your organization to use your resources to look at that issue.
Through the chair, message received.
Mr. Price, thank you for joining Senate Finance today. The next person waiting to testify is Allison Curry here in Juneau. Ms. Curry, welcome to Senate Finance. Your name for the record and any affiliation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Allison Curry. I'm the legislative liaison with Planned Parenthood Votes here in Alaska, and I'm here to oppose Senate Bill 193. Planned Parenthood is the nation's leading provider in reproductive and sexual health care. In Alaska, over a quarter of our patients are Medicaid beneficiaries, and over 80% are women. We are strongly committed to ensuring everybody has access to the health care they need, regardless of their income. The enrollment restrictions in SB 193 would decrease access to health care in our state, and this would have disproportionate impact on women. Medicaid covers 1 in 5 women of reproductive age, and Medicaid is the source of coverage for nearly half of women giving birth. Many women face barriers to work like transportation, housing, and education, and in rural Alaska, these work requirements would essentially prevent many women from accessing the basic preventive health care they need. Cutting women off from preventive care, such as contraception, is not only bad for women's health, it's also bad for our state's budget. The state saves $7 for every $1 it invests in family planning because it's simply cheaper to invest in contraceptive coverage than to pay for costs associated with unintended pregnancies. Instead of investing in the health and well-being of Alaskan women, this bill would kick many women off of Medicaid who are trying to avoid pregnancy, but then require the state to cover the costs of their unintended pregnancies after they lose access to publicly funded family planning. Research has also shown that punitive work requirements don't actually decrease poverty, and in some cases can push families even deeper into poverty. This bill would cut Alaskans off from the care they depend on without improving their economic stability, and the numerous fiscal notes make it clear that it would do so at significant cost to the state. Thank you. In short, if this bill were to pass, our state would spend more money to provide less access to health care. And I'd like to finish with just a reminder to the committee that it's already been presented here that 80% of Medicaid recipients in the state are working, and some are even state employees. So I'd like to point out that this bill seems like a solution in search of a problem. And we urge you to oppose this legislation and instead invest in proven and cost-effective strategies to improve women's health and economic security, like reducing barriers to birth control. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Curry. We do have questions. Senator Bishop, followed by Senator Machicki.
Thank you for your presentation this morning. Can you tell me what's punitive? What's Planned Parenthood's definition of punitive? As far as the work, I mean, I'm just looking at 20 hours a week. Is that what you're referring to, the 20 hours a week is punitive?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I guess I wouldn't consider, 20 hours of work a week punitive, but I think it is punitive to kick somebody off of Medicaid simply because they can't find work or they're not able to work. And my last statement, reminding folks that the majority of Medicaid recipients are already working, and I would say the remaining 20% probably aren't working because they can't. I don't have all the reasons why they can't work in front of me, but there is research that has been presented already in front of this committee.
Senator Bishop, follow-up.
Just a quick follow-up. I said partially what you said 2.5 months mm-hmm. ago, right? Former Commissioner of Labor, Workforce Development. Mm-hmm. Workforce Development has been my career for 25 years, and I don't disagree with some of the things that you've said, but I don't think 20 hours is out of line. And I would just ask, if you look at these exemptions under here, and if you got a moment, stop by my office and tell me what other exemption might make you come around to liking this bill.
Through the chair.
Thank you,
Senator Bishop.
Senator Machicki, followed by Senator Von Imhoff.
Just curious, Ms. Curry. This also allows volunteer opportunities to be counted. Mm-hmm. And do you have a problem with, throughout the great state of Alaska, someone having an expectation that an individual participate in valuable social activities going on in their community where they could perhaps volunteer 20 hours a week and therefore may learn that they're really good at something that could provide an opportunity for their to reach their greatest human potential by learning about that through the volunteer process?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I find great value in volunteering time and giving back to the community, but I feel it is a fallacy to believe that the people who are currently on Medicaid don't have a desire to contribute to their community. And I also don't see how putting in 20 hours of volunteer work rather than seeking employment and working, how that is going to increase somebody's economic standing to be able to afford health insurance if they're kicked off of Medicaid.
Senator Machicki, follow-up.
I kind of answered that in two ways. I think this gives multiple ways for people to contribute, and that's all the bill is asking, is that individuals do contribute in their communities. The other question I have, throughout the U.S., it's just the way I kind of view government, is that I think we must be there to support those that are physically disabled, seniors, and those that can't work for whatever reason. Throughout the U.S., and I can share multiple articles with you that are on my desk as we speak, Those individuals are being displaced to receive services because of healthy individuals that happen to be receiving services. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that we should prioritize services in a way that recognizes someone's inability to work above asking reasonable contribution from those that are capable of working?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, I think those who are able to contribute to the community do in the capacity that they do. And I think Planned Parenthood has a hardline stance that we believe everybody deserves access to health care. And it seems like this bill is really focusing on the Medicaid expansion population. And I think we've established that their income level is not at a range where they can afford health insurance on their own, and they're still deserving of access to health care to keep them healthy so they can continue to go to work and be productive. And I think we need to put health care first, get people healthy, and then they can be productive in their current employment or seeking new employment if they aren't currently employed.
Senator Michicki, we have two people in line and another bill to get to.
Yeah, just a final one, Madam Chair. This doesn't, in my view, this doesn't deal with the expansion population because they're already working. It's on another population in the eligibility categories, but thank you for that.
Thank you, Senator Michicki. Senator Von Imhoff, followed by Senator Bishop.
Thank you. You mentioned something about we want to get people healthy first and then they can go ahead and work. Medicaid eligibility for some population is not health, but income. So they could be extraordinarily healthy, mm-hmm. but at a certain level of income, and therefore qualify. As Senator Bishop pointed out, there are extraordinarily number of exemptions that many of them target your population, such as pregnant women, women that are caring for elderly or small children. One of the exemptions is participating, if a person is participating in a tribal work program, they don't have to participate in this Medicaid work program. Do you have any concerns about someone participating in a tribal work program? If you could extend your concerns on a Medicaid work program versus a tribal work program, much of your concerns are the same, meaning people are working under a tribal work program. What's stopping you from being concerned about that program?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I don't have an answer to that. That's not something I've thought about.
Thank you, Ms. Curry.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop has had his questions answered. Okay. Ms. Curry, thank you for bringing your perspective to the table today. We appreciate your comments.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Is there anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 193? We have someone calling in. Mr. Mike Coons. Mr. Coons, are you there?
Yes, Senator McKinnon. This is Mike Coons. I'm the president of the Alaska chapter at AMAC, and I'm speaking for my chapter. According to the New York Post, April 10th, President Trump just signed an executive order to require work for welfare, and I sent that link to you in my written testimony. Quote, President Trump's new executive order on welfare reform has laid the groundwork to get more Americans back to work while protecting and strengthening the safety net for the truly needy. Federal agencies must take advantage of this opportunity to roll back harmful Obamacare policies that have trapped families in dependency and cost taxpayers billions, end quote. Back when President Clinton was in office, the House and Senate passed and the Clinton signed welfare reform. President Obama, through executive orders, in essence, repealed that. Now we have a president that has undone Obama's executive orders and getting welfare reform back on track. Senator Kelly's bill, along with other states, Tennessee being the latest, adds to what the president has done. For far too long, we have shelled out tens of billions of dollars to generations of families on welfare, food stamps, now EBT cards, and Medicaid. The era of LBJ and his great society hopefully is drawing to a close. Last number I've heard is nationally we have spent over $2 trillion, and poverty is worse in real numbers than when LBJ started this monster. This is but another step to reduce the cost of Medicaid over the Medicaid reform that has already been passed by this legislature. I am hopeful that the next step is to strip the Cadillac plan that Medicaid presently has down to what is really needed. Pass out of committee and pass on the floor, and let's take advantage of our president's work to make America and Alaska great again. And lastly, I would like to add, I agree with Senator Von Inhofe's comments on helping with, you know, the aspect of helping with health care for those that are not at that point in their employment and their income, cash flow income, to be able to help them with their insurance. I think that's a viable discussion that I think would be of help, but still that gives the people the chance to get out and work and have the like I think Senator Kelly said, that satisfaction of being able to look at himself in the mirror each and every day, knowing that they've actually done something and accomplished something for not only themselves, but their company they're working for and for the community. And lastly, we totally oppose Planned Parenthood's talking points and big government stance, and I would welcome any questions.
Are there questions from committee members? Mr. Coons, we are in receipt of your written testimony, and we appreciate you calling in to Senate Finance today. Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 193, an act requiring the Department of Health and Social Services to apply for a waiver to establish work requirements for certain adults who are eligible for state medical assistance? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. If I could invite Deputy Commissioner John Sherwood and Monica Windham to the table. Senators, do you have questions of the department on the bill, at least the structure of it before us, so that they can be prepared for any questions when this bill comes back before us? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just hope we'll find some way of notifying the folks what educational opportunities are available to them, and appreciate hearing more about what the department is going to do, not at this time, but at some time in the future. Thank you.
Any other questions? I'm not sure who is appropriate to ask this to, but it was, I'll start with the question. If people, I believe in the statement that was said earlier at this committee table that health is important to people and they should maintain that health, and we have services at a government level that are supporting some who cannot provide for themselves. Under the Medicaid program and the criteria of income, if someone has a child, does that increase their benefits?
For the record, my name is Monica Windham. I'm the director for the Division of Public Assistance. Chairperson McKinnon, I'm sorry, I lost your question. I apologize.
That's quite all right. In qualifying as a single adult, you get X amount of benefits. If you can share with the committee what that might be. If it's a family, if you have a child, do those benefits increase? And if so, how do they increase?
They do not. The benefit package is the same for Medicaid recipients.
It doesn't go up. And can you tell me how many pregnancies in Alaska were covered by Medicaid?
Madam Chair, for the record, this is John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. I don't have the exact number in front of me. I know that historically Medicaid covers around 50%, but we can provide the specifics to you.
Mr. Sherwood, I already have the specifics. Otherwise, I wouldn't have asked the question. 50% of all live births in Alaska last year, I believe, or the year before, were 50% covered by Medicaid. So every birth Alaska paid with the help of the federal government, one in two births.
So if there were two births, Alaska paid for one. Just wanted to get that on the record. Any other questions for committee members? It does affect program growth in other areas for food stamps or other dollars that the state, food stamps is a poor example of where the state dollars are leveraged, but it does affect benefits when there are additional children involved. Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, you asked a question. I'm not sure the public would understand the answer completely when you asked if it increases benefits for having a child. What wasn't discussed is how the federal poverty line is affected by that. So it does dramatically affect eligibility. The more children that you have, the more people in the household, I'll put it that way, the higher the income can be for the family. And in some cases, with several children, the income level can be quite high for several other programs. And that's not the fault of the department. That's legislation that we have passed in this, or that has been passed here in this body in the past. And that is something we have to look at. But although it doesn't necessarily increase the programs that are available, it certainly raises the level of income where you're still eligible for receiving those programs.
And the child that was born would qualify for that Medicaid or child assistance also?
Correct.
Thank you. Any other questions for the department? Thank you for joining Senate Finance today. We will cover the fiscal notes at a later date. Ms. Carpenter, did you have anything to provide the committee before we set this bill aside?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just in wrap-up, I just wanted to correct a statement by Ms. Curry. She said this bill was after just the expansion population. That's not entirely correct. The CMS guidance letter specifically says abled body enrollees in Medicaid. That happens to include the expansion population. That doesn't mean it will be entirely the expansion population. And happy to talk off record. Have many personal stories about individuals I worked with that, you know, some were told they were too disabled to work, and I think that's just disingenuous. So I'm excited to see what the Trump administration is looking at with work requirements and changing some of our welfare programs. Work is just an amazing opportunity to prosper and to grow, and so is education. So happy to answer questions as they arise.
Thank you, Ms. Carpenter. With that, amendments are due by tomorrow morning, Friday, April 13th at noon. With that, we'll set this bill aside. I direct the committee's attention to House Bill 79. It is a workers' compensation bill. I will not read the title. It would take some time. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up the PowerPoint. Brief at ease. I'd like to call Senate Finance Committee back to order. It is still Wednesday, April 12th. And the next bill before us is House Bill 79. It's an act relating to workers' compensation. I would like to put on the record for committee members two items. I would like to notify you that in your packet you have a letter from Associated General Contractors of Alaska sent by John McKinnon. I'm Anna McKinnon. That is my husband. I just want to put that on the record. I would also like to have everybody smile as we recognize how small Alaska is, that the presenter today, Heidi Dragas, Commissioner of Labor, is my niece. So just so that the public has been notified, I will consider all items fairly and make sure that this meeting is handled as such also. Senator Bishop.
I'll mediate this, Donnybrook.
Thank you. I was in a meeting yesterday, and the reason I share that very sincerely is that just because everyone at this table knows many of our family members, and otherwise the general public does not, and I would never want there to be an appearance of impropriety. I believe that the commissioner is here laboring on behalf of both the employers and the employees that they have, as well as all of the other folks that are testifying. They may have difference of opinions that we'll hear about today, different ways to solve problems, but all of those positions are valid. And again, the general public is watching, and I appreciate their participation in the process. With that said, because we're going to run up against the Senate finance floor, I've asked Commissioner Dragas if she would hold for a moment so that we can go to public testimony and let folks who've been following this bill have their opportunity before we move into a presentation that may pose questions and delay the public from being able to comment on this important piece of legislation. With that, do I have the committee's support to move into public testimony? I'd like to open the public testimony on the CS for House Bill 79 Finance. It's version N, and it is available online in Senate Finance. The first person waiting to testify is Lori Bonaire. Lori, are you there? Laura.
Hi. My name is Laura Bonner, and I'm retired. But I want to testify today because my husband suffered an on-the-job injury that resulted in a long-term disability. That was a number of years ago. I support House Bill 79 because it allows for better access to medical care and quicker resolution of the disputes. Both are really important to the injured worker and their families. They are not only dealing with the pain and suffering of the injury, but also the stress of paying the family bills, who's going to pay the doctor, and what accommodations or modifications may be needed in the home, and also who's going to mow the lawn or shovel the driveway. I'm also glad to see language in the bill which defines an independent contractor and strengthening the fraud provisions for employers who try to cheat the system. That fraud hurts other employers' ability to compete, and the misclassification of employees really hurt younger people. So thank you for allowing the time to testify, and thank you for all your hard work.
Thank you for testifying before Senate Finance. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, we did have a few people sign up. I'd like to invite Don Etheridge from AFL-CIO to the microphone and Barbara Huff-Tuckness from Teamsters. Mr. Etheridge, if you could identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don Etheridge with the Alaska AFL-CIO. And the Alaska AFL-CIO is coming out in support of HB 79. We worked with the department and other groups to work on the classification, misclassification section, and everybody come out of it halfway happy, so I figured we had a pretty good description on things there, so we were in agreeance with that portion of it. The other comment I wanted to make was I brought this up in Labor and Commerce too, and some of you got the opportunity to meet one of our former laborers out of 341 that was paralyzed in the Whittier Tunnel, and this was back in 99. And until I had him up here and wandered around with him a little bit, I didn't realize how important things like being able to get out to your mailbox and to get to the bank to deposit your workers' comp checks could be. That is a major chore for Jerry to get there. And in this piece of legislation, it makes it so that they can do direct deposits into their accounts, and that would make it so much easier for guys like Jerry that are impaired to the point where it's hard to even get out of bed in the morning. So I think that's a great thing for the injured worker to be able to have direct deposit into their accounts. I think it's easier for employers to be able to do a direct deposit to account rather than have to sit down and write out checks, because outside of my wife, I don't know too many people that still do that anymore. But we are very supportive of this legislation, and thank you for your attention to it.
Thank you, Mr. Etheridge. Are there questions from committee members? Ms. Huff-Tuckness, welcome to Senate Finance. Your name for the record and any affiliation.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Tuckness. I'm the Director of Government Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959, and I appreciate the opportunity to go on record supporting House Bill 79. Just from a general perspective, we represent about 7,000 members across the state in various industries. In fact, all industries with the exception of fishing out there. So we would cover mining, telecommunication. We have two hospitals that we represent, one in Kodiak, one in South Peninsula Hospital in Homer, as well as truckers throughout the state, and construction, mining. We have Usabelli Coal Mine. So we have a lot of employers out there that will also see some benefits with the passage of House Bill 79. One of the huge discussions as this bill was moving through committee did actually have a lot to do with the definition or the clarification on the independent contractor language. There were a lot of individuals from industry side as well as from labor side that spent a lot of time ironing out those differences. That language is in the bill before you, and we hope that everybody takes a good look at it and considers the impacts there as well as the additional changes within 79 that probably go a long way to working for both sides. And I would like to go on record, when this bill was first introduced, and I'm sure the commissioner is going to wonder what I'm about to say, but when this bill was first rolled out, I presented her with a 2.5-page letter of all the questions that we had, the Teamsters, regarding this bill. And with the assistance of Director Marks and the commissioner, we spent about 2.5 hours actually walking through this piece of legislation early on. And once we better understood it, we've also become a strong supporter of the bill. So we appreciate the time and ask that you move the bill from committee. Thank you.
Are there questions from committee members? Thank you, Barbara, for testifying before Senate Finance. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 79, Finance/N? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Commissioner Dryguess, I'd like to invite you to the microphone, as well as Maria Marks. This will provide, I hope, the committee a little bit more time before we run up against the bells to be able to ask questions as we move through this presentation. It's my intent to announce that amendments are due on Friday at 5 p.m. Depending on how complicated any concerns are, it may take us longer than that, but just so committee members know, it's my intent to try to cover the bill. Commissioner Dreyfus.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, for hearing SB 79 today, and thank you, members of this committee. For the record, my name is Heidi Dragas. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. HB 79 is titled an omnibus bill, but it really should be called an efficiencies bill. This bill will assist the department, department's ability to administer the workers' compensation system. It focuses mainly on efficiencies and modernizing our current work comp system, which has not been significantly reformed in more than 10 years. This bill has been through several committees and is well vetted. With me today is Marie Marks, the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation, and she'll take us through the bill.
Are there questions on the intent of the bill? Please, Ms. Marks, your name for the record, and then please proceed with your presentation. The presentation for the general public is online in the Senate Finance Committee. Workers' Compensation, HB 79, it says it's labeled Senate Finance Committee, and the date on that presentation is April 10th, 2018, and Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Commissioner Heidi Dreyfus is listed on the presentation title or page.
Good morning, Madam Co-Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Marie Marks, and I'm the Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. I just want to quickly start with a refresher. It is probably old news to all of you, but workers' compensation is a grand bargain, and it's in a bargain where the employer provides prompt medical care to an injured worker for a work-related injury, and that medical care is limited. Medical cost, wage loss, death benefits in the case of a work-related death, and reemployment benefits. And in exchange, the injured worker gives up the right to sue the employer. The Workers' Compensation Act is what guides the division's administration, and more specifically, the mission of the Workers' Compensation Act. And that mission is to ensure the quick, efficient, fair, and predictable delivery of benefits to injured workers at a reasonable cost to employers. And I point that out because whatever the division does, the department does, it's always balancing these five pillars. HB 79, as the Commissioner Dreyfus mentioned, focuses on fairness, quickness, and efficiency in the workers' compensation process. This bill primarily is about modernization and efficiency. By design, it does not tackle substantive benefits. There's things in here that I think the department has been trying to do for many years, such as, you know, right now reports of injury have to be mailed in on a stamped envelope, things that have not happened because they have gotten caught up in substantive benefit issues. The good news is, just some good news to share, is that following some recent legislative changes, premium rates are dropping. Medical costs are going down. Just wanted to share that good news. This bill really focuses on efficiencies. So first, one way that the HB 9 makes things more efficient is it speeds up dispute resolution. It simplifies and quickens the hearing process by letting the board schedule a hearing shortly after a claim is filed, and that's sections 19 and 21. What happens right now is an injured worker files a claim, and it's litigated. And it's litigated for years until the parties tell the board they want a claim. Now, this is different than any other tribunal where they come in and set a scheduling order. This has led to very high attorney's fees. By having the parties come in after a claim is filed and set a scheduling order with a hearing date far in the future that parties can prepare for, this will reduce litigation costs, reduce attorney's fees, and bring hearings to resolution much quicker. It speeds up dispute resolution by originally, the original version of the bill said non-attorneys cannot represent parties before the board. This is because currently, non-attorneys who are not bound by professional and ethical rules, your friend, a cousin, even a spouse of another spouse can show up at a hearing and represent parties before the board. It does not make things go more efficiently. The bill originally said non-attorneys may not represent parties before the board. Through public testimony, this has now changed. And as a compromise, the current version of the bill, it says, well, the board can come up with a list and regulation, a very detailed, long, specific list of who may represent a party before the board, such as maybe a retired attorney. And so forth. Currently, the board has to approve attorney's fees in a settlement agreement, and the bill will not require this if attorney's fees are the only issue that needs board approval and both sides are represented by attorneys. And then finally, it changes the civil penalty assessment process, instead of requiring the parties to go to a board hearing, a very long, drawn-out process in every case, the division investigators, a special investigation unit, will assess a penalty, and the employer can appeal to the board, and if they disagree. But if they agree, then they can just pay it. Similar to a traffic ticket, where you get issued a ticket and you can pay it, or you can contest it at the court. HB 79 improves the delivery of medical care. Currently, there's no language in the Workers' Compensation Act requiring an insurance company or self-insured employer to pre-authorize medical care. And we're really talking about expensive surgeries. And this has led to much litigation in Supreme Court case. What happens is a treating doctor does not want to move forward with an expensive surgery, like a back surgery, unless they have a guarantee of payment. The insurance company says, right now, the act only requires us to pay a medical bill, so go get the surgery, send us the bill, and we have 30 days to pay it. And the injured worker says, I'll live with my pain. I don't want that surgery if I think I'm going to be on the hook for a $10,000, $20,000 medical bill. So it's a standoff right now, and it's being litigated. And so to resolve this, HB 79 will put in a duty for an employer to either pay it or deny it within 60 days. And just like a payment for a medical bill, right now there's a 25% penalty if you don't pay a medical bill on time or don't deny it, take some action, there will be the similar penalty for failing to pre-authorize. And the last bullet point is just to clarify, we're not changing medical bills. Medical bills still will need to be paid within 30 days. The division is also tackling misclassification in HB 79. We're tackling this because it benefits both workers and law-abiding businesses. We are really doing a great disservice to both when we do not tackle this head-on. When workers are fraudulently misclassified, they can be severely injured because often the employers are not abiding by safety codes, and uninsured losses can put a company out of business. Currently, the Workers' Compensation Act tasks the Special Investigation Unit, our Fraud Investigation Unit, with investigating failure to insure cases and investigating misclassification. This unit was established in 2005 specifically for the purpose of investigating workers' compensation fraud, including misclassification. But unfortunately, in the Act, there is no definition of misclassification. It's too vague. It doesn't provide parties and the public with notice on what is misclassification. So HB 79 corrects that and clarifies that by defining misclassification and when it amounts to fraud. There is also no affirmative duty for an injured worker to report work or wage loss benefits. Now, if you ask an injured worker, if an insurance company asks them, are you working, they can't lie. But there is currently no affirmative duty for an injured worker to tell the employer that they're working. And so it puts affirmative duty on the injured worker to report those wage loss benefits. Part of a section of the bill is Section 73738. It closes a loophole for liability for benefits for limited liability companies. Currently, limited liability companies are not liable for uninsured injuries. And it was because when the statute was created, they weren't in existence. And so HB 79 would just, similar to corporate officers who are liable for uninsured injuries, it would also make LLC members liable for uninsured injuries. There is no definition in current law of independent contractor. So HB 79 defines independent contractor. This, I think, was probably the biggest source of contention in HB 79. And through a lot of collaboration with many stakeholder groups, a consensus was reached on the definition of independent contractor. And the current definition allows true bona fide independent contractors to operate, while at the same time making it clear to the public what it means to be an independent contractor. No surprises.
I have a question. Sure. Can you please put the independent contractor language on the record? Brief it is while we get there. We're back on the record.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Again, for the record, Marie Marks, Division of Workers' Compensation. I will put the language of the independent contractor definition on the record, starting with page 17, line 1, and it's subsection 12. A person employed as an independent contractor, semicolon, a person is an independent contractor for the purposes of this chapter only if the person, A, has an express contract to perform the services, B, is free from direction and control over the means and matter of providing services, subject only to the right of the individual for whom or entity for which the services are provided, to specify the desired results, completion schedule, or range of work hours, or to monitor the work for compliance with contract plans and specifications, or federal, state, or municipal law. C, incurs most of the expenses for tools, labor, and other operational costs necessary to perform the services, except for materials and equipment that could be supplied. D, has an opportunity for profit and loss as a result of the services performed for the other individual or entity. E, is free to hire and fire employees to help perform the services for the contracted work. F, has all the business, trade, or professional licenses required by federal, state, or municipal authorities for a business or individual engaging in the same type of services as the person. G, follows federal Internal Revenue Service requirements by I, obtaining an employer identification number if required. Double I, filing business or self-employment tax returns for the previous tax year to report profit or income earned for the same type of services provided under the contract. Or three little I, intending to file business or self-employment tax returns for the current tax year to report profit or income earned for the same type of services provided under the contract if the person's business was not operating in the previous year. And H, meets at least two of the following criteria. I, the person is responsible for the satisfactory completion of services that the person is contracted to perform and is subject to liability for a failure to complete the contracted work or maintains liability insurance to complete the contracted work or other insurance policies necessary to protect the employee's financial interests and customers of the person's business. And I'm going to restate that little I. The person is responsible for the satisfactory completion of services that the person has contracted to perform and is subject to liability for a failure to complete the contracted work, or maintains liability insurance or other insurance policies necessary to protect the employee's financial interests and customers of the person's business. Two little I, the person maintains a business location or a business mailing address separate from the location of the individual for whom or the entity for which the services are performed. And finally, three little I, the person provides contracted services for two or more different customers within a 12-month period or engages in any kind of business advertising, solicitation, or other marketing efforts reasonably calculated to obtain new contracts to provide similar services.
Ms. Marks, does this section affect the bill that we've just passed on Uber and other Uber drivers? What's the other? There, Lyft, there are multiple. Is this the same section of code that the department was after during that discussion too?
Madam Chair, this language would not affect the transportation network drivers because their bill exempted them from the provisions. Certain drivers that meet the qualifications exempted those drivers from the provisions of the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act.
Thank you for that clarity. Senator Bishop, did you have a question? Please continue.
HB 79 also allows the Benefits Guarantee Fund, which is the Injured Worker Fund, to file a lien for compensation and civil penalties. The Injured Worker Fund will pay when an employer is found not to have insurance and there's an uninsured injury. Then they need to go to the employer to get reimbursement. By the time they go do that, some unscrupulous employers have gotten rid of those assets. And so this would allow them to file a lien only for reimbursement of those compensation payments, those medical costs and lost injuries that the Injured Worker Fund had to pay, and civil penalties. All that goes back into the Injured Worker Fund. Everything that those civil penalties and stuff go back into the Injured Worker Fund. HB 79 allows the division to assess a penalty for misclassification. Currently, the division can only assess a civil penalty when an employer fails to carry insurance. But if they have misclassified employees, either by calling roofers, office clerical staff, or saying they have no employees, or five, you know, one employee when they really have five, it allows a division to assess a penalty for that. A significant part of this bill is to reduce the civil penalty for failure to insure cases. It changes that calculation. I should say in most cases, for most employers, it will significantly reduce it. Currently, the penalty assessed for an employer's failure to insure is $1,000 per employee per day. This has led to astronomically high penalties. They do not withstand appeal, and frankly, they're uncollectible. When an employer gets a penalty, and here's an example from a case, a real-life case, an employer was assessed $1.2 million penalty. The premium the employer would have paid, the financial gain that they had, if they had insured as required by law, was a little over $2,000. Under the bill, the calculation has changed to a maximum of three times the penalty they would have paid had they had insurance. So under the scenario I just gave you, the maximum which could have been assessed in that case is $6,500 or so. The idea is to make these penalties in line with real, more realistic, therefore hopefully more collectible as well. And this calculation is simpler because it only requires the employer's overall payroll data. And then the division of assurances, class codes and rates for that. That's easy to find. It's online. Our investigators, that's what they do. That's what they do is they investigate, get payroll information, assign class codes to the amount, and do a simple math calculation.
Senator Bishop.
Ms. Marks, and you're taking into effect the experience rate for employers when in this calculation?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, no, it would not. And thank you for that point. The calculation would be very simple. And you're right, it probably would be even less than the premium they would have paid because premiums include the building blocks, and that's all we're using is the building blocks, the base rate. On top of that, just like if you have car insurance and you're not that great a driver, I have a teenage daughter, sometimes the rates go up. You know, if you have a good history of driving, your rates are lower. We are not adding that premium increase or decrease. It's simply the building blocks that we would apply to come up with a calculation and do three times that.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Please continue.
Sure. And so just again to reiterate, the new penalty will result in a reasonable deterrent to take in account the employer's size, the nature of their business, and the financial gain that the employer realized by operating without paying in full or in part workers' compensation insurance.
If we could pause there. I am looking at a letter from F&W Construction, and both on Section 9 and 35, there is a comment that I must have missed it, regarding these sections that inside the legislation, the Department of Labor is allowed to start doing premium audits?
Madam Co-Chair, I haven't had a chance to go through that letter. It hadn't been provided to the department, but I think there may be some misunderstanding about what the department does. The department does not do premium audits. It investigates fraud and misclassification, and that's why it was created in 2005. And so what it does is just what I explained. You take the payroll, you take the risk rate, and you multiply. It is not an audit like an insurance company would go in. But it investigates fraud and collects evidence in its investigation, as the legislature, when they created it in 2005, tasked them to do.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's for fraudulent and injured workers as well, too, the fraud unit.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, you are correct.
Thank you.
And, Madam Co-Chair, I do want to state on the record that the department's goal is not to penalize. We are proactive. Our goal is to be proactive and educate. And, frankly, when industries, it comes to our attention, maybe that they had been calling workers independent contractors instead of employees, and we had that with some heliskiing companies recently, we worked with them. We educated them. We sent them letters and said, listen, you calling a heliskiing guide that you mandate their hours and you pay, calling them an independent contractor doesn't make them an independent contractor. Here's what you need to do. We did not penalize them. We wanted to bring them in compliance. The department's goal is to bring employers into compliance. And this protects injured workers, but it protects employers from huge uninsured losses that can put them out of business. Yeah, and I'll segue into an example with the heliskiing. That is why I'm bringing it up. So we had reached out to the heliskiing operators and said, you need to have work comp coverage. These guides that you bring up on a regular basis are your employees. And everyone eventually got into compliance except one company. And they fought us and said, you can't make us have work comp coverage. And we tried to explain, it's for your benefit. Fought us, but finally got coverage. And it came to our attention because there was an uninsured injury, a broken leg, I believe. And that's how we came to the attention. And most things come to our attention through uninsured injuries or tips. We frankly don't have the staff to go out and be looking for people. And again, that's not our goal. Our goal is to educate. A year later, the heliskiing, a really tragic accident, but a heliskiing guide died in an accident. And that owner called us and said, thank you. Thank you for getting us coverage because we would have been put out of business by this uninsured injury.
Thank you for those comments. In addition, I'm just looking at one letter in our packet. The provision is deleting the statute of limitations on claims. So, and then there's a second piece. There's an assertion that with no cap on attorney fees, there's no incentive to settle, but just to continue to argue. Those are my words, not the letter's words.
Yes. Madam Co-Chair, HB 79 does not get rid of a statute of limitations. There is currently a provision in the Act that says once a claim is filed, and if the employer denies it after it's filed, that an employee has to ask for a hearing within 2 years. And if they don't ask for the hearing, their claim is barred. And this goes back to what I was saying, where the parties litigate and they litigate until someone asks for a hearing. There's reasons you can excuse that or move that to your deadline, but HB 79 will put a scheduling order, and we will schedule a hearing just like every other tribunal the court system does. So that two-year time bar for not requesting a hearing is moot, would be moot if HB 79 passed.
So looking at a second piece, it's all regarding the sections that you have in front of us. This one's from Shattuck Grumman Insurance, and they're suggesting we should delete Section 11, more penalties and red tape, hostile business work environment. My words again, if you want to talk to us about Section 11.
Madam Co-Chair, absolutely, and I did realize I didn't answer the second portion of your question about attorney's fees, but I just want to reiterate that with the efficiencies that are put in place, we will end the protracted litigation, which will ultimately have the goal of reducing attorney's fees. We're already seeing those changes. Just so you know, attorney's fees are going down. But in answer to your question on Section 11, Section 11 sets forth the process for what happens after a civil penalty is assessed. And what it says is, we're not in the goal of putting out employers out of business, so it allows them to enter into a payment plan, and that's Section 11J. They can do a payment plan. They have to pay interest at the state rate, and that's in here as well. Section 11 also does not allow a civil penalty assessment to be suspended. Currently, the Workers' Compensation Board, I think to deal with those astronomically high penalties, suspends all of it or part of it. There's no sideboards on it, and it's really arbitrary, and it's hard for an employer to know in advance what the penalty will be. Of course, on appeal, the Workers' Compensation Board can reduce it, say the board, you know, the division got it wrong, uphold it, and so forth. They just can't suspend it.
With that, Ms. Marks, I would like to get back to the presentation, and we'll provide you with the committee comments that we've received, or you can access them online. All of the businesses that have actually responded to this hearing that are at work, putting workers to work and supporting them there. We'll let you take a look at those so that you can be prepared to go through those particular concerns that the business community is voicing in regards. And some of them are saying that 79 is a good step in the right direction, but they have areas of concern on particular sections. So it's not... At least so far, I haven't seen it outright opposition to 79, but a hand being extended to try to work with the department in balancing employees and employers' interests in this issue. If we could go to the presentation, and if you could quickly finish up, I've asked for the floor to be delayed for 10 minutes. I'm not sure that that's been approved, so I've gotten my committee in trouble before as we try to get to the end of the presentation. So it's not unlike me to get people in trouble sometimes. But we do have the majority leader with us. So.
Absolutely, Madam Co-Chair, and I agree about the balance. Again, balance is that focus has always been the balance, and that's why, again, the significant part of this is reducing those astronomically high penalties. And the last point on the slide that I think I haven't covered is right now an employer has 7 days to pay a penalty. That $1.1, $1.2 million, 7 days to pay it, this would extend it to 30 days. Again, all part of that balancing. A couple things that were touched on in public testimony. Currently, the Workers' Compensation Act requires benefits to be paid by check. We're modernizing the system. It's not going to prescribe a payment method. Electronic deposit would be allowed. Also, stamped envelope for reports of injuries must be mailed in, allow things to be done electronically. And then the Corporate Executive Officer Program, we would get rid of that process and move to a much simpler process where if you have a 10% ownership interest in the business, that's enough for you not to be an employee. And the Division of Corporations has a great database you can look at to verify that. Again, simplifying efficiency modernization. HB 79, some housekeeping items, adds publications to a list. This has to do with the Medical Services Review Committee and their work. The second bullet point is currently an insurance company has to tell the department when there's insurance coverage in place for an employer. There is no penalty right now, no real penalty. The way it works right now is it loops to something that doesn't exist. And so it's a cleanup thing on that and say, okay, insurance company, you need to tell us so we don't waste our efforts. Our investigators don't waste their time investigating an employer they think is uninsured only to find out there's a policy. It's sitting on someone's desk. And the former director asked these insurance companies, why aren't you timely reporting this to us? So they said, well, the states that have a consequence for not doing it timely get to the top of the pile. The states that don't go to the bottom of the pile. So again, for the balance, an insurance company would have, instead of 10 days, 30 days to report it, but there would be some consequence if you're late, a penalty for that. The HB 79 will phase out the second injury fund. This will save administrative costs and reduce costs for employers, which are required to contribute to the fund annually. I believe that it's 6% of wage loss benefits that they contribute. The fund's purpose was established to encourage employers to hire and retain those with disabilities. But with the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, you can't ask somebody before you offer them a job whether they have a pre-existing disability. So the purpose of the fund is moot, and states are phasing them out. About half the states have already phased out these funds. Under the bill, employers' contributions to the fund would gradually drop to zero as those claims are paid. And finally, Section 1 ensures adequate funding for the Workers' Safety and Compensation Administrative Account. The WISCA balance is rapidly declining. This is because programs have been added over the years, such as the Appeals Commission or the Fraud Unit, with no increased revenue. The bill allows, it does not collect more money from insurance companies. We are not collecting any more money. It's always been 2.7%, and that will stay the same. All the department is asking that instead of only 1.82 be diverted for these workers' compensation programs, that 2.5 be diverted to it. And that is the end of the presentation.
Senator Bishop.
Yes, and I'm pretty sure all my committee members know what the WISCA account does, but those that are listening at home, Ms. Marks or Commissioner, just give us a real quick snapshot of what the WISCA funds do, what they pay for in your shop.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the WISCA funds are dedicated funding to ensure that workers' compensation and safety programs operate and have sufficient funding, and they pay for our operations. We do not receive any UGF, but if a change isn't made, fiscal year 2020 will be a shortfall, and the division will have to be asking, the department will be asking for UGF to continue funding its workers' safety and workers' compensation programs.
Thank you.
Are there questions from committee members? With that, I'd like to invite the department back to the committee on Friday, tomorrow at 9 a.m. And if we could go through a sectional, I understand that you just did a high level, but in regards to the comments that we're receiving, at least at the top of my pile, from insurance companies as well as from employers, and I'm sure that we have actually individual workers inside of that conversation also. We'll do a walkthrough of the sectional, and then if you would please access our online information so that you know the questions that we'll be asking in regards to the employers and others that are commenting, employees and the insurance companies that I just saw flipping through it right now. Do you have any closing comments for consideration? The floor has been delayed until 11:15 for committee members.
No, thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and committee members.
Thank you for that succinct presentation. On Thursday's, on this afternoon's agenda, we have HB 110, massage therapy licensing, HB 318, extension of the Board of Social Worker Examiners, HB 323, extended Board of Pharmacy, and we've added SB 185, reemployment of retired teachers and admin to this afternoon's schedule. That could get pushed. We may have to come back later tonight depending on our floor schedule, or those would roll to Friday morning's meeting. With that, we're adjourned.